He agreed, and in September 1968 did precisely that. His name was Geoffrey Prime. Karpov, to be able to continue to run Prime, was transferred under diplomatic cover to the Soviet embassy in London, and continued to control Prime for 3 years, until in 1971 he came back to Moscow and handed the control over to a successor. But the case had done his career a power of good, and he was promoted major with a transfer back to the Third Department. From here, he handled Prime's source material through the mid-70s. It's axiomatic in any intelligence service that an operation producing excellent material will be noted and praised, and the officer controlling that operation is inseparable from the praise. In 1977, Prime resigned from GCHQ. The British knew there was a leak there somewhere, and the hounds were sniffing. In 1978, Karpov went back to London, this time as head of the entire Residentura, with the rank of colonel. Although out of GCHQ, Prime was still an agent, and Karpov sought to warn him to keep a very low profile indeed. There was, Karpov pointed out, not a shred of proof as to his pre-1977 activities, and Prime could only inculpate himself. He'd be a free man today if he'd only been able to keep his dirty hands off little girls, thought Karpov savagely, for he had long known of Prime's inadequacy, and it was eventually a grubby, indecent assault charge that brought the police to his door, and to his confession. He got 35 years on 7 charges of spying. But London brought 2 bonuses to offset the reverse of the Prime affair. At a drinks party in 1980, he had been introduced to a civil servant from the British Defence Ministry. At first, the man had not heard Karpov's name correctly, and there were several minutes of polite conversation before the man realised Karpov was a Russian. When he did so, his attitude changed. Behind his abrupt and icy attitude, Karpov discerned a visceral loathing of himself, either as a Russian or as a communist. He was not upset, just intrigued. He learned the man's name was George Berenson, and further inquiries over the succeeding weeks revealed that the man was a dedicated anti-communist and passionate admirer of South Africa. He privately tagged Berenson as a possible for a false flag approach. In May 1981, he'd returned to Moscow to head the Third Department itself, and asked around for a possible South African pro-Soviet sleeper. The illegals director had mentioned that they had 2 men there, one an officer called Gerhardt in the South African Navy, the other a diplomat called Marais. But Marais had just returned to Pretoria after 3 years in Bonn. It was in the spring of 1983 that Karpov went up to Major General and to the head of the illegals directorate controlling Marais. He ordered the South African to ask for a London posting to terminate his long career, and in 1984 Marais got it. Karpov personally flew to Paris under deep cover and briefed Marais himself. Marais was to cultivate George Berenson and try to recruit him for South Africa. In February 1985, after the death of Kirpichenko, Karpov succeeded to his present post, and a month later, in March, Marais reported that Berenson was on the hook. That month, the first batch of Berenson material came through. It was solid 24-carat gold, the mother lode. Since then, he had personally run the Berenson-Marais operation as a director's case, twice in 2 years meeting Marais in European cities to congratulate and debrief him. The bagman had that very lunch hour brought the latest batch of Berenson material, mailed by Marais to a KGB address in Copenhagen. The London spell from 1978 to 1981 had brought a second benefit. As was his wont, he had given Prime and Berenson his personal code names. Prime had been Knightsbridge, and Berenson was Hampstead. And then there was Chelsea. He respected Chelsea, as he despised Prime and Berenson. Unlike the other two, Chelsea was not an agent, but a contact, a man high in his own country's establishment, and a man who, like Karpov, was a pragmatist, a man wedded to the realities of his job, his country, and the surrounding world. Karpov never ceased to be amazed at journalistic references in the West to intelligence officers living in a world of fantasy. For him, it was the politicians who lived in their dream world, seduced and bemused by their own propaganda. Intelligence officers, he believed, might walk in shadowed streets, lie and deceive to carry out their mission, but if they ever wandered into the realm of fantasy, as the CIA's covert action people had done so often, that was when they came badly unstuck. Chelsea had twice dropped hints that if the USSR continued on a certain course, there would soon be a fearsome mess for them all to clear up. Twice he had been right. Karpov, able to warn his own people of impending danger, had scored a mountain of credits when he turned out to be correct. He stopped, and forced his mind back to the present problem. Borisov was right. It was the General Secretary mounting some kind of a personal and private operation right under his nose and inside Britain, but excluding the KGB from any part of it. He sensed danger. The old man was no professional intelligence officer, despite his years at the head of the KGB. Karpov's own career might hang in the balance, yet it was vital to find out what on earth was going on. But carefully, very carefully. He checked his watch, 11:30. He beckoned his car forward, climbed in, and was driven home to Moscow. Barry Banks arrived at the headquarters of the SIS at 8:50 that Monday morning. Sentinel House is a large, square, and surprisingly tawdry-looking building on the South Bank, leased to a certain government ministry by the Greater London Council. Its lifts are erratic, and around its lower floors a mosaic mural is forever shedding its tiles like ceramic dandruff. Banks identified himself at the front desk and went straight up. The master received him at once, his usual bluff and genial self towards aspiring underlings. "Do you know a chap called John Preston at 5, by any chance?" asked C.
"Yes, sir. Not well, but I've met him several times, usually in the bar at Gordon when I've been over there."
"He heads C1A, doesn't he, Barry?"
"Not any more. He's been transferred to C5C last week."
"Oh, really? That's rather sudden. I heard he'd done rather well at C1A. Sir Nigel felt no need to inform Banks that he had met Preston at the JIC meetings or used him as his personal ferret in South Africa. Banks knew nothing of the Berenson affair, nor did he need to know. For his part, Banks wondered what the master had in mind. So far as he knew, Preston had nothing to do with Six. Very sudden. In fact, he was only at C1A for a few weeks. Up till the new year, he was head of F1D. Then he must have done something that upset Sir Bernard, or more likely Brian Harcourt Smith. He was booted out of there into C1A. Then on April the 1st, he was given the heave-ho again.
Ah, thought Sir Nigel. Upset Harcourt Smith, did he? Suspected as much. Wonder why?
Aloud, he said, "Any idea what he could have done to upset Harcourt Smith?"
"I did hear something, sir. From Preston. He wasn't talking to me, but close enough to me to hear. He was in the bar at Gordon at the time, about 2 weeks back. He seemed a bit upset himself. Apparently he spent years preparing a report and submitted it last Christmas. He thought it was worth attention, but Harcourt Smith NFA'd it."
"Hmm. F1D, that's extreme left activities, isn't it? Look, Barry, I want you to do something for me. No need to make a song and dance about it, just quietly. Find out the file number on that report and draw it from registry, will you? Put it in the bag and send it over here, marked me personally."
Banks found himself back on the street and heading north towards Charles just before 10.
The Aeroflot crew had a leisurely breakfast, and at 9:29 First Officer Romanoff checked his watch and went to the men's toilets. He had been there before and ascertained the cubicle he was to take. It was the second from the end. The one at the end already had its door closed and locked. He went into the adjacent one and locked the door. At 9:30, he placed a small card on which he had written the prescribed 6 figures on the floor next to the partition. A hand came under the partition, withdrew the card, wrote something on it, and placed it back on the floor. Romanoff picked it up. On the reverse side were the 6 figures he had been expecting. With identification established, he placed the transistor on the floor, and the same hand drew it silently into the next door cubicle. Outside, someone was using the urinal. Romanov flushed the pan, unlocked the door, washed his hands until the urinal user had left, then followed him out. The minibus for Heathrow was at the door. None of the crew noticed as Sony was missing. They just thought it was in his grip. Courier One had delivered. Barry Banks phoned Sir Nigel just before the hour of noon. It was an internal line and very secure. "It's rather odd, Sir Nigel," he said. "I secured the file number of that report you wanted and went to registry for it. I know the file clerk pretty well. He confirmed it's in the NFA section, but it's out."
"Out? Out? Withdrawn? By whom?"
"A man called Swanton. I know him. The odd thing is, he's in finance. So I asked him if I could borrow it. That's the second odd thing. He refused. Said he wasn't finished with it yet. According to registry, he's had it 3 weeks. Before that, it was out to someone else."
"The lavatory attendant?" asked Sir Nigel.
"Almost. Someone in admin." Sir Nigel thought for a while. The best way to keep a file permanently out of circulation was to keep it on permanent withdrawal to oneself or one's protégés. He had little doubt Swanton and the other man were Harcourt Smith's young men.
"Barry, I want you to find out Preston's personal address. Then meet me here at 5.
General Karpov sat at his desk that afternoon at Yasyenova and rubbed his stiff neck. It had not been a restful night. He had lain awake most of it, with Lyudmila sleeping by his side. By dawn he had come to a conclusion, and further thought, in the moments he could snatch from his daily work, had not altered it. It was the General Secretary who was behind the mysterious operation being mounted in Britain, but despite his pretensions to read and speak English, he had no knowledge of the country. He would have relied on the advice of someone who did. There were many in the Foreign Ministry, the International Department of the Central Committee, the GRU and the KGB, but if he was avoiding the KGB, why not the others? So, a personal adviser. And the more he thought, the more the name of his personal bête noire kept cropping up. Years ago, as a young man making his way in the service, he had admired Philby. They all had. But with the passing years, he had risen while Philby had fallen. He had also watched the English renegade deteriorate into a drunken wreck. The fact was, Philby had not been near a British classified document, except those shown to him by the KGB, since 1951. He had quit Britain in 1955 for Beirut, and had not even been in the West since his final defection in 1963. 24 years. Karpov reckoned he knew Britain better than Philby by now. There was more. He knew that when he was at the KGB, the General Secretary had in some way become impressed by Philby, his old-world mannerisms and tastes, his affectation of the English gentleman, his dislike of the modern world with all its pop music, motorcycles and blue jeans, tastes that mirrored the General Secretary's own. Several times, to Karpov's certain knowledge, the General Secretary had had recourse to Philby's advice as a sort of backstop to the advice he received from the first Chief Directorate. Why not now? Finally, in Karpov's catalogue, there was the tip that once, just once, Philby had let something slip, something extremely interesting. He wanted to return home. For that, if for nothing else, Karpov did not trust him, not one inch. He recalled the lined, smiling face across the table from him at Kryuchkov's dinner party before the New Year. What had he said about Britain then? Something about her political stability being overestimated by his department. There were pieces, and they were beginning to slot together. He decided to check out Mr. Harold Adrian Russell Philby. But he knew that even at his level, things were noted. Withdrawals from registry, official requests for information, phone calls, memoranda. It had to be unofficial, personal, and above all, verbal. The General Secretary was a very dangerous man to antagonize. John Preston had arrived in his own street and was 100 yards from the entrance to his apartment block when he heard the hail. He turned to see Barry Banks crossing the road towards him.
"Hello, Barry.
Small world. What are you doing here?" He knew the man from K7 lived up north in the Highgate area. Perhaps he was going to a concert at the nearby Albert Hall.
Waiting for you, actually, said Banks with a friendly grin. Look, a colleague of mine wants to meet you. Would you mind? Preston was intrigued, but not suspicious. He knew Banks was from Six, but not who might want to meet him. He allowed Banks to guide him across the road and 100 yards down. Banks stopped at a parked Ford Granada, opened the back door, and gestured Preston to look inside. He did so. Good evening, John. Do you mind if we have a couple of words? In surprise, Preston climbed in beside the seated figure in the greatcoat. Banks closed the door and wandered away. Look, I know it's an odd way to meet, but there we are. Don't want to cause any waves, do we? I just felt I had not had a decent opportunity to thank you for the work you did down in South Africa. It was a first-class job. Henry Pienaar was most impressed. So was I. Thank you, Sir Nigel. Now, what on earth did the wily old fox want? It certainly wasn't that. But C seemed lost in thought. There is another matter, he said at length, as if thinking aloud. Young Barry tells me it has come to his notice that last Christmas you put in a most interesting report about the extreme left in this country. I could well be wrong, but there might have been a foreign dimension to some of the funding going on, if you see what I mean. The thing is, your report was not circulated to us in the firm. Pity that. It was NFA'd, said Preston quickly. Yes, so Barry tells me. Pity, really. I'd have liked to have a glance at it. No chance of getting hold of a copy.
It's in the registry, said Preston, puzzled. It may be NFA'd, but it's on file. Barry's only got to withdraw it and send it over in the bag.
Actually, no, said Sir Nigel. It's already been withdrawn by Swanton, and he hasn't finished with it. Won't pass it over.
But he's in finance, protested Preston.
Yes, murmured Sir Nigel regretfully, and before that it was out to someone in admin. One might almost think it was being kept out of sight.
Preston sat there stunned. Through the windscreen he could see Banks dawdling up the street. There is another copy, he said. My own. It's in my personal safe.
Banks drove them. In the evening traffic it was a crawl from Kensington to Gordon Street.
An hour later, Preston leaned through the window of the Granada and handed his copy to Sir Nigel.
Chapter 14. General Yevgeny Karpov climbed the last of the stairs to the third floor of the apartment block on Prospekt Mira and rang the buzzer. After several minutes, the door opened. Philby's wife stood in the frame. From inside, Karpov could hear the sound of small boys at the tea. He had chosen 6 p.m. on the hunch that they would be home from school by then. Hello, Erita. She tilted her head back in a small gesture of defiance, a very protective lady. Perhaps she knew Karpov was no admirer of her husband. Comrade General. Is Kim at home? No, he's away. Not he's out, but he's away, thought Karpov. He affected surprise. Oh, I had hoped to catch him. Do you know when he'll be back?
No, he'll be back when he'll be back.
Any idea where I might contact him?
No.
Karpov frowned. Something Philby had said at that Kryuchkov dinner about not being allowed to drive since his stroke. He had already checked the basement car park. The Philby Volga was there. I thought you drove him around these days, Erita. She had a half-smile, not the face of a woman whose husband has walked out on her, more the smile of a woman whose husband has obtained a promotion.
Not any more. He has a driver.
I'm impressed. Well, sorry to have missed him. I'll try and catch him when he gets back. He descended the stairs, deep in thought. Retired colonels did not rate a personal driver. Back in his own flat, 2 blocks behind the Ukrania Hotel, he called the KGB motor pool and insisted on speaking to the chief clerk. When he identified himself, the reaction was suitably deferential. He was bluff and jovial. I'm not in the habit of handing out bouquets of carnations, but I see no reason not to when good work has been done. Thank you, Comrade General. That chauffeur who's been driving for my friend Comrade Colonel Philby, he speaks extremely highly of him. Very fine driver, so he says. If my own man is ever sick, I must ask for him personally. Thank you again, Comrade General. I'll tell driver Grigoryev myself. Karpov hung up. Driver Grigoriev. Never heard of him. But a quiet talk with a man might be useful. The next morning, the 8th of April, the academic Komarov moved quietly past Greenock and into the Clyde to bound upriver for the port of Glasgow. She stopped briefly at Greenock to pick up the pilot and two customs officers. They had the usual glass in the captain's cabin and ascertained she was out of Leningrad and in ballast to pick up a cargo of heavy-duty pump accessories from Weir of Cathcart Limited. The customs men checked the crew list but did not memorise any particular name. Later it would be established that deckhand Konstantin Semyonov was on the list. The habitual practice when Soviet illegals enter a country by ship is that they do not feature on the crew list. They arrive crouched in a tiny cubbyhole or oubliette, skillfully cut into the ship's structure, and so well hidden that the most thorough rummage crew would not find it. Then, if the man for operational or accidental reasons fails to go out on the same ship, there is no discrepancy in the crew list. But this was a hurried operation. There had been no time for structural changes. The extra crewman had arrived with the men from Moscow only hours before the Komarov was due to leave Leningrad for Glasgow on a long scheduled freight run, and the captain and his resident political officer had no choice but to put him in the crew list. His seaman's pay book was in order, and he would be coming back, they were told. Nevertheless, the man had taken over a cabin to himself, spent the whole voyage in it, and the two genuine deckhands whose cabin it was had become fed up with sleeping in bags on the wardroom floor. These bags were cleared away by the time the Scottish pilot came on board. Down in his cabin, tense for evident reasons, Courier 2 was waiting for midnight. While the Clyde pilot stood on the bridge of the Komarov, and the fields of Strathclyde slid by as he munched his breakfast sandwiches, it was already noon in Moscow. Karpov called the KGB motor pool again. There was a new chief clerk on duty, as he knew there would be. "My driver looks as if he's going down with flu," he said. "He'll see the day out, but I'm giving him tomorrow off. I'll ensure that you get a replacement, Comrade General. I'd prefer driver Grigoriev. Is he available? I've heard the best reports of him." There was a rustle of paper as the clerk checked his files. "Yes, indeed. He's been on secondment, but he's back in the pool." "Good. Have him report to my Moscow flat at 8 tomorrow morning. I'll have the keys, and the Chaika will be in the basement." Stranger and stranger, he thought as he put the phone down. Grigoriev had been ordered to drive Philby around for a while. Why? Because there was a great deal of driving to do, too much for Erita to cope with, or so that Erita should not know where he was going. And now the man was back in the pool again. Meaning? Probably that Philby was now somewhere else and did not need a driver any more, at least not until the end of whatever operation he was involved in. That evening, Karpov told his grateful regular driver he could have the following day off and take his family out. That same Wednesday evening, Sir Nigel Irvin had a dinner date with a friend in Oxford. One of the charming things about St. Anthony's College, Oxford, like so many highly influential British institutions, is that, so far as the general public is concerned, it does not exist. In fact, it does exist, but is so small and so discreet that anyone who, surveying the groves of academe in the British Isles, blinked, would probably miss it. Its hall is small, elegant, and tucked away out of sight. It offers no degree courses, educates no students, has no undergraduates, and therefore no graduates, and awards no degrees. It has a few resident professors and fellows, who sometimes dine together in hall, but live in rooms scattered around the city, and others who live elsewhere and simply visit. It occasionally invites outsiders to address the fellows, an extraordinary honour, and the professors and fellows occasionally submit papers to the higher echelons of the British establishment, where they're taken very seriously. Its funding is as private as the profile it maintains. In fact, it is a think tank where assembled intellects, often with extensive non-academic experience, pursue the study of one single discipline, current affairs. That evening, Sir Nigel dined in hall with his host, Professor Jeremy Sweeting, and after an excellent repast, the professor took the master back to his rooms, an agreeable house on the outskirts of Oxford, for port and coffee. "Now, Nigel,"
said Professor Sweeting, when they had broached a vintage tailor and were at ease before the fire in the study. "What can I do for you?" "Have you by any chance, Jeremy, heard of a thing called the MBR? Professor Sweeting held his port in mid-air. He stared at it for a long while. "You know, Nigel, you really do have a way of spoiling a chap's evening when you have a mind to. How did you hear those letters?" For answer, Sir Nigel Irvine passed over the Preston report. Professor Sweeting read it carefully, and it took an hour. Irvine knew that, unlike John Preston, the professor was no leg man. He did not get out on the ground, but he had an encyclopedic knowledge of Marxian theory and practice, of dialectical materialism, and of the teachings of Lenin on the applicability of theory to the practice of the achievement of power. His pursuit, and his absorption, was to read, study, collate, and analyze. "Remarkable," said Sweeting as he handed back the report. "A different approach, a different attitude, of course, and a completely different methodology, but we've come up with the same answers." "Care to tell me what answers you have come up with?" asked Sir Nigel gently. "It's only theory, of course," apologized Professor Sweeting. "A thousand straws in the wind that may or may not make up a bale of hay. Anyway, this is what I've been on since June 1983. He talked for 2 hours. And when Sir Nigel left to be driven back to London in the small hours, he was a very pensive man. The academic Komarov was tied up at the Finiston Quay in the heart of Glasgow, so that the giant crane there could hoist the pumps aboard in the morning. There were no customs or immigration checks there. Foreign seamen can simply walk off the ships across the quay and into the streets of Glasgow. At midnight, while Professor Sweeting was still talking, deckhand Semyonov walked down the gangplank, followed the quay for 100 yards, avoided Betty's bar, outside whose door a few drunken sailors were still protesting their right to just one more drink, and turned up Finiston Street. He was unremarkable, dressed in scuffed shoes, cord trousers, a roll-neck sweater, and anorak. Under one arm he clutched a canvas gunny sack held closed by a drawstring. Passing under the Clydeside Expressway, he reached Argyle Street, turned left, and followed it to Party Cross. He consulted no map, but headed on into Hindland Road. A mile further on he reached another major artery, the Great Western Road. He had memorized his route days before. He checked his watch here. It told him he still had half an hour, and the rendezvous could not be more than 10 minutes' walk ahead. He turned left and proceeded in the direction of the Pond Hotel, next to the boating lake, and 100 yards past the BP service station, whose lights he could see blazing in the distance. He was almost at the bus stop at the junction of the Great Western Road and Hughenden Roads when he saw them. They were lounging about in the passenger shelter of the bus stop. It was 1:30 in the morning, and there were 5 of them. In some parts of Britain they call them skinheads, or punks, but in Glasgow they call them Neds. He thought of crossing the road, but he was too late. One of them called out to him, and they spilled out of the bus shelter. He could speak some English, but their broad, drink-slurred Glaswegian dialect defeated him. They blocked the pavement, so he stepped into the road. One of them grabbed his arm and shouted at him. What the lout actually said was, "Where you got in your wee sack, then?" But he could not understand, so he shook his head and tried to walk past. Then they were on him, and he went down under a rain of blows. When he was in the gutter, the kicking started. He dimly felt hands tearing at his gunny sack, so he clutched it to his belly with both hands and rolled over, taking the blows around the head and kidneys. Devonshire Terrace overlooks the junction, a row of solid, four-storey, middle-class houses in buff and grey sandstone blocks. On the top floor of one, Mrs. Sylvester, old, widowed, alone, and riddled with arthritis, was unable to sleep. She heard the shouts from the street below and hobbled from her bed to the window. What she saw caused her to limp across the room to the telephone, where she dialed 999 and asked for the police. She told the police operator which road junction to send the car to, but hung up when asked for her name and address. Respectable people, and those of Devonshire Terrace are very respectable, do not like to get involved. Police constables Alistair Craig and Hugh McBain were in their divisional patrol car a mile down the Great Western Road at the Hill Head end when the call came through. Traffic was nearly zero, and they reached the bus stop in 90 seconds. The Ned saw them coming from the headlights and the siren, and they ceased trying to rip away the gunny sack, choosing to race away across the grass verge that separates Hughenden Road from the Great Western, so the car could not follow them. By the time P.C. Craig could leap out of the patrol car, there were disappearing shadows, and pursuit was useless. In any case, the priority was the victim. Craig bent over the man. He was huddled in the embryo position and unconscious.
"Ambulance, Huey!"
he called across to P.C. McBain, and the driver was already on the radio. It came from the Western Infirmary 6 minutes later. Meanwhile, the two officers left the injured man strictly alone, as per procedure, save that they covered him with a blanket. The ambulance men eased the limp form onto a stretcher trolley and into the back of the vehicle. As they were tucking the blanket round him, Craig lifted the gunny sack and placed it in the rear of the ambulance.
"You go with him. I'll follow,"
shouted McBain. So Craig climbed into the ambulance as well. They all arrived at casualty admissions in less than 5 minutes. The ambulance men quickly wheeled the injured man through the swing doors, down the corridor, round two corners, and into the rear of the casualty ward. As it was an emergency admission, there was no need to pass through the public waiting room, where the usual collection of small hours of the morning drunks nursed the cuts and bruises collected while in earlier contact with a number of unyielding objects. Craig waited for McBain to park the patrol car and join him in the entrance.
You handle the admission forms, Huey. I'll go along and see if I can get your name and address.
McBain sighed. Admission forms went on forever. Craig lifted the gunny sack from the ground and followed the trolley down the passage to casualty. This department at the Western Infirmary consists of a passage with swing doors at each end and 12 curtained examination rooms, 6 either side of the central corridor. 11 of the rooms are used for examinations. The 12th is the sister's office and is nearest the rear entrance through which the trolleys come. The doors at the other end have one-way mirrors in their panels and give on to the public waiting room, where the walking wounded are made to sit and wait their turn. Leaving McBain at the porter's desk with a sheaf of admission forms to fill in, Craig went through the mirrored doors to see the unconscious man on his trolley parked at the other end. The ward sister gave him the usual once-over, he was alive at any rate, and ordered the porters to put the man on the bench in one of the examination rooms so the trolley could be returned to the ambulance. The one they chose was the room opposite the sister's cubicle. The junior houseman, an Indian called Dr. Mehta, was summoned. He had the porter strip the injured man to the waist. He could see no signs of blood leaking through the trousers, and made a lengthier examination before ordering an X-ray exam. Then he left to attend to another emergency admission from a car crash. The ward sister telephoned X-ray, but it was occupied. They would let her know when they were free. She put on her kettle to make a cup of tea. P.C. Craig, having ascertained his anonymous charge was still unconscious on his back across the corridor, took the man's anorak, entered her office, and placed both anorak and gunny sack on her table. "Have you a spare cup of that brew?" he asked the sister in the jocular familiarity used by people of the night who spend their duties cleaning up the mess of a major city.
"I might," she said, "but I don't see why I should waste it on the likes of you."
Craig grinned. He felt through the pockets of the anorak and extracted a seaman's paybook. It bore the photograph of the man in the examination room across the way, and was in two languages, Russian and French. He understood neither. He could not read Cyrillic script, but the name was in Roman letters also in the French language section.
"Who's Jimmy?"
asked the ward sister, preparing 2 cups of tea.
"Looks like a seaman, and a Russian at that," said Craig, perturbed.
A citizen of Glasgow roughed up by a gang of Neds was one thing. A foreigner, and a Russian at that, could spell problems. To try to discover what ship the man could be off, Craig emptied the gunny sack. It contained simply a rolled-up, thick-knit jersey, wrapped around a circular screw-top tobacco tin. Inside the tin was not tobacco, but cotton wool, shrouding the 2 discs of aluminium, with, between them, another 2-inch diameter disc of a dull, grey metal. Craig examined the 3 discs without interest, replaced them in their bed of cotton wool, screwed the tin shut again, and laid it on the table beside the paybook. What he did not know was that across the corridor the victim of the mugging attack had come to and was peering through the curtains at him. What he did know was that it was time to tell Division he had an injured Russian on his hands.
"Use your phone, Pet,"
he asked the sister, and reached out for it.
"Don't you pet me,"
called back the sister, who was somewhat older than 24-year-old P.C. Craig.
"God, they get younger every day."
P.C. Craig began to dial. Just what went through Konstantin Semyonov's mind will never be known. Dazed and confused, probably suffering concussion from the kicks to the head, he could see the unmistakable black uniform of a British policeman with his back to him across the corridor. He could see his own paybook and the consignment he had been told to bring to Britain and deliver to the agent at the boating lake, sitting on the table by the policeman's hand. He had watched the officer examine the consignment. He personally had never dared open the tin. And now the man was phoning. Perhaps he had visions of endless third degree in some reeking cellar beneath Strathclyde Police Headquarters. The first thing P.C. Craig knew, he was roughly elbowed aside, caught completely unawares. A bare arm pushed past him, reached for the tin and grabbed it. He responded fast, dropping the telephone and grasping the outstretched arm.
"Where the hell, Jimmy?"
he shouted, and then, assuming the poor fellow was hallucinating, he grabbed the man and tried to restrain him. The tin was shaken from the Russian's hand and fell to the floor. For a moment, Semyonov stared at the Scottish policeman, then panicked and ran, still shouting,
"Hey, Jimmy, come back here!"
P.C. Craig thundered down the corridor after him. Shorty Patterson was a drunk. A lifetime dedicated to sampling the produce of Speyside had made him unemployed and unemployable. He was no ordinary drunk. He had elevated intoxication to an art form. The previous day he had drawn his benefit and made straight for the nearest boozer, and by midnight had been paralytic. In the small hours he took exception to the offensive attitude of a lamppost that refused to respond to his entreaties for the price of a dram, so he had hit the creature. He had been an X-ray with his broken hand and was going back down the corridor to his booth when a man with a bare and battered torso and a bruised and bloody face came running out of an adjacent cubicle pursued by policemen. Shorty knew his duty to a fellow sufferer. He had no love for policemen, who seemed to have nothing better to do than pluck him out of perfectly comfortable gutters and hand him over to people who made him bath. He let the running man pass him, then stuck out a foot.
"You stupid wee bugger!"
shouted Craig as he crashed down. By the time he was up, he had lost 10 yards on the Russian. Semyonov came through the mirrored doors into the public waiting room, missed seeing the narrow door to the outside that lay to his left, and ran through the larger double doors to his right. This led him back into the trolley passage, down which he had been wheeled 30 minutes earlier. He turned right again to find a trolley approaching him, surrounded by a doctor and two nurses holding up plasma bottles, Dr. Mehta's road accident victim. The trolley blocked the whole passage. Behind him he heard running boots. To his left was a square lobby containing two lift doors. One door was closing upon an empty elevator. He threw himself through the gap just as the door closed. As the lift rose, he heard the policeman banging impotently on it. He leaned back and closed his eyes in misery. P.C. Craig made for the stairwell and ran up. At every level he checked the lights above the elevator doors. The lift was still climbing. At the top and 10th floor he was hot, angry, and puffed out. Semyonov had got out at the 10th. He looked into one door available to him, but it was a ward of sleeping patients. There was one other door, open and leading to stairs. He ran up to find himself in another corridor, but with only shower rooms, a pantry, and stores leading off it. At the far end was the last door, and in the warm, humid night it stood open. It led to the flat roof of the block. P.C. Craig had lost ground, but he made the final doorway eventually and stepped out into the night air. Adjusting his eyes to the darkness, he made out the figure of a man by the north parapet. His annoyance died away. I'd probably panic if I woke up in a Moscow hospital, he thought. He started to walk towards the figure, hands held up to show they were empty.
Come on, Jimmy. That Ivan, whatever your name is. You're all right. You got a bang in the head, that's all. Come on away down with me.
His eyes were accustomed now. He could see the Russian's face quite clearly in the glow from the city below. The man watched him approach until he was 20 feet away. Then he looked down, took a deep breath, closed his eyes, and jumped. P.C. Craig could not believe it for several seconds. Even after he heard the soggy smack of the body impacting 100 feet down into the staff car park.
"Oh, Christ," he breathed. "I'm in bother."
With fumbling fingers, he reached for his personal radio and called up division. 100 yards after the BP service station, half a mile from the bus stop, lies the boating pond, in the shadow of the Pond Hotel. From the pavement, a set of stone steps leads down to the walkway around the pool, and close to the bottom of the steps are 2 wooden benches. The silent figure in black motorcycle leathers checked his watch. 3 o'clock. The rendezvous had been for 2. 1 hour's delay was all that was allowed. There was a second backup rendezvous, different places, 24 hours later. He would be there. If the contact failed to show up, he would have to use the radio again. He rose and left. PC Hugh McBain had been away from the porter's desk when the chase ran straight through the casualty department waiting room. He was at his car, checking exact times for the mugging attack and the logged appeal calls. The first thing he knew was when his neighbour, Glasgow slang for partner, came down into the waiting room, looking pale and shaken. "Alistair, have you got that name and address yet?" he asked. "He was a Russian seaman," said Craig. "Oh, hell, that's all we need. How do you spell it?"
"Huey. He's just thrown himself off the roof." McBain put down his pen and stared in disbelief at his neighbour. Then the training took over. Any policeman knows when things go wrong, you cover your back. You follow the procedures right down the line. No cowboy tactics, no clever initiatives.
"Have you called up division?"
he asked.
"Aye, someone's on their way over." "Let's get the doctor," said McBain. They found Dr. Mitter, already worked to fatigue by the night's admissions. He followed them to the car park, spent no more than 2 minutes examining the gross and burst cadaver, pronounced it dead and no longer his concern, and returned to his duties. 2 porters brought a blanket to cover it, and 30 minutes later an ambulance took the thing to the city mortuary in Jocelyn Square by the salt market. There, other hands would strip off the rest of the clothing, shoes, socks, belt, trousers, underpants and wristwatch, each to be bagged and tagged for collection. Inside the hospital there were more forms to fill out. The admission forms were kept as evidence, although now useless for practical purposes, and the 2 police constables bagged and tagged the rest of the dead man's items. They were listed as anorak, 1, roll neck pullover, 1, canvas gunny sack, 1, thick knit jersey, rolled, 1, and round tobacco tin, 1. Before they were finished, about 15 minutes after Craig's first call, an inspector and a sergeant, both uniformed, arrived from division and asked for an office. They were loaned an empty administrator's office and began to take statements from the 2 constables. After 10 minutes, the inspector sent the sergeant to his car to call in the duty chief superintendent. It was 4 o'clock on Thursday the 9th of April, but in Moscow it was 8. General Yevgeny Karpov waited until they were out on the main traffic of southern Moscow and on the open road to Yasyenovo before he started to converse with driver Grigoryev. Apparently, the 30-year-old driver knew he had been singled out by the general and was eager to please.
"How do you like driving for us?"
"Very much, sir."
"Well, it gets you out and about, I suppose. Better than a stuffy desk job."
"Yes, sir."
"Been driving for my friend Colonel Philby recently, I hear."
A slight pause. "Damn. He's been told not to mention it," thought Karpov.
"Yes, sir. He used to drive himself until he had his stroke."
"So he told me, sir."
"Better get on with it."
"Whereabouts did you drive him?"
A longer pause. Karpov could see the driver's face in the mirror. He was disturbed, in a quandary.
"Oh, just around Moscow, sir."
"Anywhere specific around Moscow, Grigoryev?"
"No, sir. Just around."
"Pull over, Grigoryev." The Chaika pulled out of the privileged centre lane, through the southbound traffic, and into a lay-by. Karpov leaned forward.
"Do you know who I am, driver?"
"Yes, sir."
"And do you know my rank in the KGB?"
"Yes, sir. Lieutenant General."
"Then don't play games with me, young man. Where exactly did you drive him?"
Grigoryev swallowed. Karpov could see he was wrestling with himself. The question was, who had told him to stay silent as to where he had driven Philby? If it was Philby himself, Karpov outranked him. But if it was someone higher... In fact, it had been Major Pavlov, and he had frightened Grigoryev badly. He was only a major, but to a Russian, the people from the first chief directorate are an unknown quantity, whereas a major of the Kremlin guards... Still, a general was still a general. Mostly to a series of conferences, Comrade General, some at Central Moscow apartments, but I never went inside, so I never saw which exact apartment he went to. Some in Central Moscow, and the others... I think always, at a dacha out at Zhukovka. Central Committee country, thought Karpov. Do you know whose? No, sir, honestly, he just gave me directions to it, then I used to wait in the car. Who else turned up at these conferences? There was one occasion, sir, when two cars arrived together. I saw the man from the other car get out and enter the dacha.
And you recognized him?
Yes, sir. Before I joined the KGB motor pool, I was a driver in the army. In 1985, I used to drive for a colonel of the GRU. We were based at Kandahar in Afghanistan. Once this officer was in the rear seat with my colonel. It was General Marchenko.
Well, 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 thought Karpov. My old friend, Pyotr Marchenko, specialist in destabilization.
Anyone else at these conferences? Just one other car, sir. We drivers chatted a bit, what were the hours of waiting and that, but he was a surly devil. All I learned was that he drove for a member of the Academy of Sciences. Honestly, sir, that's all I know.
Drive on, Grigoryev.
Karpov leaned back and watched the passing landscape of trees. So, there were four of them, met to prepare something for the General Secretary. The host was Central Committee, or Supreme Soviet, and the other three were Philby, Marchenko, and an unnamed academician. Tomorrow was Friday, when the Vlasti finished as early as they could and went to their dachas. He knew Marchenko had his villa close to Pyeredelkina, not far from his own. He also knew Marchenko's weakness, and sighed. He had better take a lot of brandy with him. It would be a heavy session. Chief Superintendent Charlie Forbes listened to PCs Craig and McBain carefully and quietly, interjecting a soft-spoken question now and again. He had no doubt they were telling the truth, and he had been long enough in the force to know the truth does not always save your neck. It was a bad business. Technically, the Russian had been in police custody, even though under treatment at a hospital. There had been no one else on that roof but PC Craig. There was no evident reason why the man should have jumped. He personally did not even care why, assuming, like everyone else, that the man had been severely concussed and in a state of panic due to temporary hallucination. His whole attention was on the possible perspectives for the Strathclyde police. There would be the ship to trace, the captain to interview, formal identification of the body, the Soviet consul to be informed, and, of course, the press, the bloody press, some elements of whom would hint darkly at their usual hobby horse, police brutality. The dour thing was, when they asked their pointed questions, he did not have any answers. Why should this silly man have jumped? At 4:30, there was nothing more to do at the hospital. The machine would roll into action by dawn. He ordered them all back to Divisional HQ. By 6:00, the two PCs had finished their lengthy statements. Charlie Forbes was in his office, coping with the demands of the procedural machine. A search, probably futile, was on for the lady who had dialed 999. Statements had been taken from the two ambulance men who had answered McBain's call via the divisional switchboard. At least there would be no doubt about the beating the Neds gave the man. The casualty ward sister had told her version. The harassed Dr. Mehta had made a statement. The casualty front desk porter had testified to seeing the bare-chested man run through the waiting room pursued by Craig. After that, no one had seen either of them on the chase up to the roof. Forbes had identified the only Soviet ship in port as the Akademik Komarov and dispatched a police car to ask the captain to identify the body. He had awoken the Soviet consul, who would be at his office at 9, protest at the ready, no doubt. He had alerted his own chief constable and the procurator fiscal, whose office in Scotland includes the duties of a coroner. The dead man's personal effects, the productions, had all been bagged and were being taken to Partick police station. The mugging had been in Partick, to be retained under lock and key on the direction of the procurator fiscal, who had promised to authorise the post-mortem for 10 a.m. Charlie Forbes stretched and called the canteen for coffee and rolls. While Chief Superintendent Forbes, at the Strathclyde HQ in Pitt Street, sorted out the paperwork, across at Division, PCs Craig and McBain signed their statements and repaired to their canteen for breakfast. Both were worried men, and they shared their worries with a grizzled detective sergeant from the plainclothes branch who shared their table. After breakfast, they sought and received permission to go home and sleep. Something they said caused the detective to go to the payphone in the hall outside the canteen and make a call. The man he disturbed, with a face full of shaving foam, was Detective Inspector Carmichael, who listened carefully, hung up, and finished his shaving in pensive mood. D.I. Carmichael was from the special branch. At 7:30, Carmichael traced the chief inspector in the uniformed branch, who might be attending the post-mortem, and asked if he might tag along. "Be my guest," said the chief inspector. "City morgue at 10. At that same morgue at 8 o'clock, the captain of the Akademik Komarov, accompanied by his inseparable political officer, stared at a video screen on which the battered face of deckhand Semyonov soon appeared. He nodded slowly and muttered in Russian. "That is him," said the political officer. "We wish to see our consul." "He'll be at Pitt Street at 9 o'clock," said the uniformed sergeant who was accompanying them. Both Russians appeared shaken and subdued. "It must be bad to lose a close shipmate," thought the sergeant. At 9, the Soviet consul was ushered into the Pitt Street office of Chief Superintendent Forbes. He spoke fluent English. Forbes asked him to be seated and launched into a narration of the night's events. Before he finished, the consul was coming back at him.
"This is outrage," he began. "I must contact the Soviet embassy in London without delay."
There was a knock on the door, and the captain was shown in with his political officer. The uniformed sergeant was their escort, but another man was with them. He nodded to Forbes. "Morning, sir. Mind if I sit in?" "Help yourself, Carmichael. I think it's going to be a rough one." But no. The political officer from the ship had hardly been in the room 10 seconds before he drew the consul aside and whispered furiously in his ear. The consul made his excuses, and the two men withdrew to the corridor. 3 minutes later, they were back. The consul was formal and correct. He would, of course, have to communicate with his embassy. He was sure the Strathclyde police would do all in their power to apprehend the hooligans. Would it be possible for the body of the seaman and all his effects to depart for Leningrad on the Akademik Komarov, which was due to sail this day? Forbes was polite, but adamant. Police inquiries to arrest the muggers would continue. In that period, the body would have to remain at the morgue, and all the dead man's effects would be retained under lock and key at Partick Police Station. The consul nodded. He, too, understood procedures. And with that, they left. At 10, Carmichael entered the post-mortem room, where Professor Harland was scrubbing up. The chatter, as usual, was about the weather, the golf prospects, the norms of everyday life. A few feet away on a slab, above the drains, lay the battered and pulped body of Semyonov.
"Mind if I have a look?" asked Carmichael.
The police pathologist nodded. Carmichael spent 10 minutes looking over what was left of Semyonov. When he left, just as the professor started to cut, he went to his office at Pitt Street and made a call to Edinburgh, more precisely to the Scottish Home and Health Department, known as the Scottish Office, at St. Andrew's House. There he spoke to a retired assistant commissioner who was on the staff of the Scottish Office for one reason, liaison with MI5 in London. At noon, the phone rang in the office of C4C in Gordon. Bright took it, listened for a moment, and held it out to Preston. "It's for you. They won't talk to anyone else." "Who is it?" "The Scottish Office, Edinburgh." Preston took the phone.
"John Preston?"
"Yes." "Good morning to you." He listened for several minutes, his brow furrowed. He noted the name Carmichael on a scratch pad. "Yes, I think I'd better come up. Would you tell Inspector Carmichael I'll be on the 3 o'clock shuttle, and could he meet me at Glasgow Airport? Thank you." "Glasgow?" asked Bright. "What have they been up to?" "Oh, some Russian seaman who took a tumble off a roof and who may not have been all he should have been. I'll be back tomorrow. It's probably nothing. Still, anything to get out of the office."
Chapter 15.
Glasgow Airport lies 8 miles southwest of the city and is linked by the M8 motorway. Preston's flight landed just after 4:30, and with only a hand grip to carry, he was in the concourse 10 minutes later. He went to airport information and they paged Mr. Carmichael. The detective inspector of Special Branch appeared, and they introduced themselves. 5 minutes later, they were in the inspector's car and pulling onto the motorway towards the darkening city. "Let's talk as we drive," suggested Preston. "Start from the beginning and tell me what happened." Carmichael was succinct and accurate. There were a lot of gaps he could not fill in, but he had had time to read the statements of the two police constables, especially that of P.C. Craig, so he could recount most of it. Preston heard him out in silence. "So what caused you to phone the Scottish office and ask for someone to come up from London?" he asked at length. "I could be wrong, but there seems to me a possibility the man was not a merchant seaman," said Carmichael. "Go on." "It was something Craig said in the canteen at Division this morning," said Carmichael. "I wasn't there, but the remark was overheard by a CID man who called me up. What Craig said, McBain agreed with, but neither of them mentioned it in their official statements. As you know, statements are about the facts. This was the police officer's speculation. Still, it seemed worth checking out." "I'm listening." "They said when they found the seaman, he was huddled in the embryo position, his hands clasped round the gunny sack, which was pressed into his belly. The phrase Craig used was that he seemed to be protecting it, like a baby." Preston could see the oddity. If a man is being kicked half to death, the instinct is to roll into a ball, like Semyonov, but to use the hands to protect the head. Why would a man take the force of the kicks on an unprotected head in order to guard a worthless canvas bag? "Then," resumed Carmichael, "I began to wonder about the time and place. Seamen in the port of Glasgow go to Betty's or the stable bar. This man was 4 miles from the docks, walking up a dual carriageway towards nowhere, long after closing hours, without a bar in sight. What the hell is he doing there at that hour?"
"Good question," said Preston. "What next?"
"At 10 this morning, I went to the post-mortem. The body was pretty badly smashed by the fall, but the front of the face was all right, except for a couple of bruises. Most of the blows from the Neds were to the back of the head and the body. I've seen the faces of Merchant Navy deckhands before. They're weather-beaten, wind-burned, brown and lined. This man had a bland, pale face, the face of a man not accustomed to life on the foredeck. Then his hands, they should have been brown on the backs, calloused on the palms. They were soft and white, like those of a desk worker. Lastly, the teeth. I'd expect a deckhand out of Leningrad to have basic dentistry, the fillings of amalgam and any false teeth of steel, Russian style. This man had gold fillings and 2 gold caps. Preston nodded approvingly. Carmichael was sharp. They had arrived in the car park of the hotel where Carmichael had booked Preston for the night. "One last thing, small, but it may mean something," said Carmichael. "Before the post-mortem, the Soviet consul went to see our chief super at Pitt Street. I was there myself. It seemed he was on the verge of lodging a protest. Then the captain of the ship arrived, and his political officer was with him. The officer pulled the consul into the passage, and they had a whispered conversation. When the consul returned, he was all civility and understanding. It was as if the political officer had told him something about the dead man. I got the impression they didn't want to make any waves at all until they had checked with the embassy."
"Have you told anyone in the uniform branch that I'm here?" asked Preston.
"Not yet," replied Carmichael.
"Do you want me to?"
Preston shook his head. "Wait till the morning. We'll decide then. It may be nothing."
"Anything else you want?"
"Copies of the various statements. The lot of you can get them. And the list of the dead man's effects. By the way, where are they?"
"I looked up at Partick Police Station. I'll get you the copies and drop them off here later."
General Karpov called a friend in the GRU and spun a story to the effect that one of his bagmen had brought him a couple of bottles of French brandy from Paris. He personally never touched the stuff, but he owed Pyotr Marchenko a favour. He would drop the brandy over at Marchenko's dacha during the weekend. He just needed to know there would be someone to take it in. Did the colleague have Marchenko's country number at Pyridelkina? The GRU man did, indeed. He gave it to Karpov and thought no more about it. Most of the duchas of the Soviet elite have a housekeeper or manservant in residence during the winter months to keep the fires alight so that the owners' weekends do not start freezing cold. It was Marchenka's housekeeper who answered. Yes, the general was expected the following day, Friday. He usually arrived about 6 in the evening. Karpov thanked her and hung up. He decided he would dismiss his chauffeur, drive himself, and surprise the GRU general at 7. Preston lay awake in his bed, thinking. Carmichael had brought him all the statements taken at the Western Infirmary and at Division. Like all police-recorded depositions, they were stilted and formal, quite unlike the way people actually narrate what they have seen and heard. The facts were there, of course, but not the impressions. What Preston could not know, because Craig had not mentioned it and the ward sister had not seen it, was that before running off down the passage between the examination rooms, Semyonov had grabbed for the round tobacco tin. Craig had simply said, "The injured man pushed past me." Nor was the list of personal effects, the productions, much more helpful. It mentioned a round tobacco tin and contents, which could have been 2 ounces of shag tobacco. Preston ran over the possibilities in his mind. 1. Semyonov was an illegal being landed in Britain. Deduction? Very unlikely. He was on the crew list of the ship and would be conspicuous by his absence when the vessel departed for Leningrad. All right. So, he was to come into Glasgow with the ship and leave with it that Thursday night. What was he doing in the small hours halfway up the Great Western Road? Making a drop or keeping a rendezvous? Good. Or even collecting a package to bring back to Leningrad? Even better. But after that, the options ran out. If he had delivered what he came to deliver, why try to protect his gunny sack as if his life depended on it? It would have been empty of its cargo. If he had come to pick something up, but had not yet done that, the same reasoning applied. If he had already made the pick-up, why was not something of considerable interest, such as a packet of papers, found on his person? If what he had come to deliver or collect could be concealed about a human form, why bring a gunny sack at all, if there was something sewn into his anorak or trousers, or concealed in the heel of a shoe, why not let the Neds take the sack, which was what they were after? He could have saved himself a beating and got to his rendezvous or back to his ship, whichever direction he was heading, with a couple of bruises. Preston threw a few more possibles into the food mixer. He had come as a courier to make a face-to-face rendezvous with a Soviet illegal already resident in Britain, to pass a verbal message. Unlikely. There were a score of better ways of passing coded information. To receive a verbal report. Same applied. To change places with the resident illegal to replace the man. No, the photograph in his paybook was identifiably Semyonov. If he had been changing places with an illegal, Moscow would have given him a duplicate paybook with the appropriate photograph, so the man he was replacing could go out on the Komarov as deckhand Semyonov. That paybook would have been on his person, unless it was sewn into the lining. Of what? The lining of his jacket? Then why take a beating to protect the sack? The canvas base of the sack itself? Much more likely. It all seemed to come back to that damn sack. Just before midnight, he called Carmichael at his home. "Can you pick me up at 8? He asked. "I want to go to Partick and have a look at the productions. Can you front me?"
Over breakfast on the Friday morning, Yevgeny Karpov told his wife, Lyudmila, "Can you take the kids out to the dacha in the Volga this afternoon?"
"Of course. You'll join us straight from the office?"
He nodded absently. "I'll be late. I've got to see someone from GRU. Lyudmila Karpova sighed inwardly. She knew he kept a partridge plump little secretary in a small apartment in the Arbat district. She knew because wives will talk. And in a society as stratified as theirs, most of her social friends were the wives of other officers of similar rank. She also knew he did not know she knew. She was 50, and they'd been married 28 years. It had been a good marriage, considering the job he did, and she had been a good wife. Like others who had married officers of the FCD, she had long lost count of the evenings she had waited up, while he had been buried in the cipher room of an embassy on foreign soil.
She had stuck it through the endless tedium of countless diplomatic cocktail parties, speaking no foreign language, while her husband made the rounds, elegant, affable, fluent in English, French, and German, doing his job under embassy cover. She had lost count of the week she had spent alone, when the children were small and he was a junior officer, their home a tiny and cramped apartment without any daily help, and he away on a course or an assignment, or standing in the shadows by the Berlin Wall waiting for a bagman to come home to the East. She had known the panic and nameless fear that even the innocent feel when, on foreign station, one of the colleagues had gone over to the West, and the KR, counterintelligence people, had grilled her for hours about anything the man or his wife might have said in her hearing. She had watched in pity as the defector's wife, a woman she might have known well, but dare not now touch with a sterilized barge pole, was escorted to the waiting Aeroflot plane. It went with the job, he had said, as he comforted her. That had been years before. Now her Genia was a general. The Moscow apartment was airy and spacious. She had made the Dutcher lovely in the way she knew he liked, with pine and rugs, comfortable but rustic. The two boys were a credit to them, both at university, one to be a doctor, the other a physicist. There would be no more horrid embassy apartments, and in 3 years he could retire with honours and a good pension. So, if he had a bit of skirt one evening a week, he was no different from most of his contemporaries. Perhaps better the way it was than he'd be a drunken brute, like some, or a passed-over major going nowhere but to one of the forsaken Asian republics to end his career. Still, she sighed inwardly. Partick Police Station is not the most glamorous edifice in the fine city of Glasgow, and the productions from the previous night's mugging-stroke-suicide had simply slotted into the routine. The duty desk sergeant handed over to a constable and led Carmichael and Preston to the rear, where he unlocked a bare room stacked with filing cabinets. He accepted Carmichael's card without expression of surprise, and his explanation that he and his colleague had to check the productions in order to complete their own reports, the dead man being a foreign seaman and that. The sergeant knew all about reports. He spent half his life filling them in. But he declined to quit the room while they opened the bags and looked over the contents. Preston started with the shoes, checking for false heels, detachable soles, or cavity toe caps. Nothing. The socks took less time, as did the underpants. He had the back off the shattered wristwatch, but it was just a wristwatch. The trousers took longer. He felt all the seams and hems, looking for new stitching or a thickness that could not be accounted for by a double layer of the fabric. Nothing. The roll-neck jersey the man had been wearing was easy. There were no seams, and no hidden papers or hard lumps. He spent much longer on the anorak, but it, too, yielded no fruit. By the time he got to the gunny sack, he was more convinced than before that if the mysterious comrade Semyonov had had something with him, the answer lay here. He started with the rolled-up sweater that had been in it, more for elimination purposes than anything. It was clean. Then he began on the sack itself. It took half an hour before he was satisfied the base was just a double-stitched disc of canvas. The sides of single canvas and the eyelets at the top were not miniature transmitters, nor the cord a secret aerial. That left the tobacco tin. It was of Russian origin, an ordinary screw-top tin, and still smelt faintly of pungent tobacco. The cotton wool was cotton wool, and that left three discs of metal. Two shiny like aluminium, and light in weight. The other dull, like lead, and heavy. He sat staring at them for a while as they lay on the table. Carmichael looked at him, and the sergeant looked at the floor. It was not what they were that puzzled him, it was what they were not. They were not anything. The aluminium discs had been above and below the heavy disc. The heavy one was 2 inches in diameter, the lighter one's 3 inches. He tried to imagine what purpose they could possibly serve. In radio communications, coding and decoding, in photography. And the answer was nothing. They were just metal discs. Still, he was more than ever convinced that a man had died rather than let them fall into the hands of the Neds, who'd have thrown them in the gutter anyway, or than let himself be interrogated about them. He rose and suggested lunch. The sergeant, who felt he'd wasted a morning, put the productions back in their bags and relocked them in a filing cabinet. Then he showed them out. During lunch at the Pond Hotel, Preston had suggested they drive past the spot of the mugging. He excused himself to make a telephone call. "I may take a while," he told Carmichael. "Have a brandy on the Sassenach." Carmichael grinned. "I'll do that, and I'll toast Bannockburn." Out of sight of the dining room, Preston left the hotel and walked over to the BP filling station, where he made several small purchases from the rack of parts in the adjacent shop. Then he went back to the hotel and made his call to London, giving the number of Partick Police Station and telling his assistant Bright exactly when he wanted the call back. Half an hour later they were back in the police station, where a plainly disgruntled sergeant led them once again to the room where the productions were stored. Preston seated himself behind the table, facing the wall phone across the room. In front of him on the table, he built up a rampart of clothing from the various bags. At 3 o'clock, the phone rang. The switchboard was putting the London call through to the extension. The sergeant took it.
"It's for you, sir. London on the line," he said to Preston.
"Would you mind taking it?" Preston asked Carmichael. "Find out if it's urgent." Carmichael rose and crossed the room to where the sergeant held the phone. For a second, both the Scottish officers were facing the wall. 10 minutes later, Preston was finished for the last time. Carmichael drove him back to the airport. "I'll file a report, of course," said Preston, "but I can't see what the hell the Russian was so fussed about. How long will these productions spend locked up in Partick?"
"Oh, weeks yet. The Soviet consul's been told that. The search for the Neds is still on, but it's a long shot. We might pick up one of them on another charge and get a squeal, but I doubt it."
Preston checked in. Boarding was immediate.
"You know, the stupid thing is," said Carmichael as he saw him off, "if that Russian had stayed cool, we'd have driven him back to his ship without apologies, him and his wee toy with him."
When the plane was airborne, Preston went to the toilet for a bit of privacy and examined the 3 discs that he had wrapped in his handkerchief. They still meant nothing to him. The 3 washers he had obtained from the garage shop and switched for the Russian's wee toys would suffice for a while. In the meantime, there was a man he wanted to look at the Russian discs. He worked outside London, and Bright should have asked him to stay on that Friday evening until Preston arrived.
Karpov arrived at General Marchenko's dacha in darkness, just after 7. The door was answered by the general's batman, a soldier, who showed him into the sitting room. Marchenko was already on his feet and seemed both surprised and pleased to see his friend from the other and bigger intelligence service.
"Yevgeny Sergeyevich," he boomed, "what brings you to my humble cottage?"
Karpov had a carrier bag in his hand. He held it up and delved inside. "One of my boys just got back from Turkey, via Armenia," he said. "A bright lad. He knows not to come empty-handed. Since his bugger-all in Anatolia, he stopped at Yerevan and put these in his grip."
He produced one of the 4 bottles the bag contained, the finest of all the Armenian brandies. Marchenko's eyes lit up.
"Akhtamar!" he shouted. "Nothing but the best for the FCD.
"Well," continued Karpov easily, "I was driving to my own place up the road, and I thought, who will take a glass of Akhtamar to help me through it?" And back came the answer. "Old Peter Marchenko." So I made a short detour. Shall we see what it tastes like? Marchenko roared with laughter.
"Sasha! Glasses!" he shouted.
Preston landed just before 5, collected his car from the short-term park, and headed for the M4 motorway. Instead of turning east for London, he took the west lane towards Berkshire. 30 minutes brought him to his destination, an institution on the outskirts of the village of Aldermaston. Known simply as Aldermaston, the Atomic Weapons Research Establishment, so beloved of peace marchers looking for a target, is in fact a multidiscipline unit. It does indeed design and build nuclear devices, but it also researches into chemistry, physics, conventional explosives, engineering, pure and applied mathematics, radiobiology, medicine, health and safety standards, and electronics. By the by, it is a very fine metallurgy department. Years earlier, one of the scientists based at Aldermaston had given a lecture to a group of intelligent officers in Ulster on the kinds of metals the IRA bomb makers favoured for their devices. Preston had been one of those in the lecture hall, and recalled the Welsh scientist's name. Dr. Dafydd Wyn Evans was waiting for him in the hallway. Preston introduced himself and reminded Dr. Wynne Evans of his lecture many years ago. "Well, well, what a memory you've got," he said in his lilting Welsh accent. "All right, Mr. Preston, what can I do for you?" Preston dug into his pocket, produced the handkerchief, and held it out to show the three discs it contained. "These were taken off somebody in Glasgow," he said. "They defeat me. I'd like to know what they are and what they could be used for." The doctor looked at them closely. "Nefarious purposes, you think?" "Could be.